The unwholesome, salty decay still found me. My stomach heaved a moment, and I leaned against the scab trunk of a tree. The rough bark pricked my forehead, steadying me. I must get away from this smell, I thought. I walked north, to the palace road, a dusty strip worn smooth by wagon wheels and horses' hooves. A little beyond the palace yard it divided. One half ran south and west, through grass and rocks and low hills. That was the way I had come 3 years ago. The other half twisted northwards, towards Mount Othrys, and then beyond to Mount Pelion. I traced it with my eyes. It skirted the wooded foothills for some time before disappearing within them. The sun bore down on me, hot and hard in the summer sky, as if it would drive me back to the palace. Yet, I lingered. I had heard they were beautiful, our mountains, pears and cypress and streams of just melted ice. It would be cool there and shaded, far away from the diamond-bright beaches and the flashing of the sea. I could leave. The thought was sudden, arresting. I had come to the road meaning only to escape the sea, but the path lay before me and the mountains and Achilles. My chest rose and fell rapidly, as if trying to keep pace with my thoughts. I had nothing that belonged to me, not a tunic, not a sandal, though Apuleius is all. I do not need to pack even. Only my mother's lyre, kept in the wooden chest within the inner room, stayed me. I hesitated a moment, thinking I might try to go back, to take it with me. But it was already midday. I had only the afternoon to travel before they would discover my absence, so I flattered myself, and send after me. I glanced back at the palace and saw no one. The guards were elsewhere. Now. It must be now. I ran, away from the palace, down the path towards the woods, feet stinging as they slapped the heat-baked ground. As I ran, I promised myself that if I ever saw him again, I would keep my thoughts behind my eyes. I had learned now what it would cost me if I did not. The ache in my legs, the knifing heaves of my chest felt clean and good. I ran. Sweat slicked my skin, fell upon the earth beneath my feet. I grew dirty, then dirtier. Dust and broken bits of leaves clung to my legs. The world around me narrowed to the pounding of my feet and the next dusty yard of road. Finally, after an hour, two, I could go no farther. I bent over in pain, the bright afternoon sun wavering to black, the rush of blood deafening in my ears. The path was heavily wooded now, on both sides, and Peleus's palace was a long way behind me. To my right loomed Othrys, with Pelion just beyond it. I stared at its peak and tried to guess how much farther. 10,000 paces? 15? I began to walk. Hours passed. My muscles grew wobbly and weak. My feet jumbled together. The sun was well across the zenith now, hanging low in the western sky. I had 4, perhaps 5 hours until dark, and the peak was as far as ever. Suddenly, I understood. I would not reach Pelion by nightfall. I had no food, nor water, nor hope of shelter. I had nothing but the sandals on my feet and the soaked tunic on my back. I would not catch up to Achilles, I was sure of that now. He had left the road, and his horse, long ago, was now moving up the slopes on foot. A good tracker would have observed the woods beside the road, could have seen where the bracken was bent or torn, where a boy had made a path. But I was not a good tracker, and the scrub by the road looked all the same to me. My ears buzzed dully, with cicadas, with the shrill calls of birds, with the rasp of my own breath. There was an ache in my stomach, like hunger or despair. And then there was something else, the barest sound, just at the limit of hearing, but I caught it, and my skin, even in the heat, went cold. I knew that sound. It was the sound of stealth, of a man attempting silence. It had been just the smallest misstep, the giving way of a single leaf, but it had been enough. I strained to listen, fear jumping in my throat. Where had it come from? My eyes tracked the woods on either side. I dared not move. Any sound would echo loudly up the slopes. I had not thought of dangers as I ran, but now my mind tumbled with them. Soldiers, sent by Peleus or Thetis herself, white hands cold as sand on my throat, or bandits. I knew that they waited by roads, and I remembered stories of boys taken and kept until they died of misuse. My fingers pinched themselves white as I tried to still all breath, all movement, to give nothing away. My gaze caught on a thick clutch of blooming yarrow that could hide me. Now, go! There was movement from the woods at my side, and I jerked my head towards it. Too late. Something, someone, struck me from behind, throwing me forward. I landed heavily, face down on the ground with the person already on top of me. I closed my eyes and waited for a knife. There was nothing. Nothing but silence and the knees that pinned my back. A moment passed, and it came to me that the knees were not so very heavy, and were placed so that their pressure did not hurt.
Patroclus!
Patroclus. I did not move. The knees lifted, and hands reached down to turn me, gently over. Achilles was looking down at me.
I hoped that you would come, he said.
My stomach rolled, awash with nerves and relief at once. I had drank him in, the bright hair, the soft curve of his lips upwards. My joy was so sharp I did not dare to breathe. I do not know what I might have said then. I'm sorry, perhaps, or perhaps something more. I opened my mouth.
Is the boy hurt?
A deep voice spoke from behind us both. Achilles' head turned. From where I was, beneath him, I could see only the legs of the man's horse, chestnut fetlocks dulled with dust. The voice again, measured and deliberate.
I am assuming, Achilles Pelides, that this is why you have not yet joined me on the mountain.
My mind groped towards understanding. Achilles had not gone to Chiron. He had waited here for me.
Greetings, Master Chiron, and my apologies. Yes, 'tis why I have not come.
He was using his prince's voice.
I see.
I wished that Achilles would get up. I felt foolish here, on the ground beneath him, and I was also afraid. The man's voice showed no anger, but it showed no kindness either. It was clear and grave and dispassionate.
Stand up, it said.
Slowly, Achilles rose. I would have screamed then if my throat had not closed over with fear. Instead, I made a noise like a half-strangled yelp and scrambled backwards. The horse's muscular legs ended in flesh, the equally muscular torso of a man. I stared at that impossible suture of horse and human, where smooth skin became a gleaming brown coat. Beside me, Achilles bowed his head.
Master Centaur, he said, I am sorry for the delay. I had to wait for my companion.
He knelt, his clean tunic in the dusty earth.
Please accept my apologies. I have long wished to be your student.
The man's, Centaur's, face was serious as his voice. He was older, I saw, with a neatly trimmed black beard. He regarded Achilles a moment.
You do not need to kneel to me, Pelides, though I appreciate the courtesy. And who is this companion that has kept us both waiting?
Achilles turned back to me and reached a hand down. Unsteadily I took it and pulled myself up.
This is Patroclus.
There was a silence, and I knew it was my turn to speak. My lord, I said, and bowed.
I am not a lord, Patroclus Menoitiades.
My head jerked up at the sound of my father's name.
I am a centaur, and a teacher of men. My name is Chiron.
I gulped and nodded. I did not dare to ask how he knew my name. His eyes surveyed me.
You are overtired, I think. You need water and food, both. It is a long way to my home on Pelion, too long for you to walk. So we must make other arrangements.
He turned then, and I tried not to gawk at the way his horse legs moved beneath him.
You will ride on my back, the centaur said. I do not usually offer such things on first acquaintance, but exceptions must be made.
He paused.
You have been taught to ride, I suppose.
We nodded quickly.
That is unfortunate. Forget what you learned. I do not like to be squeezed by legs or tugged at. The one in front will hold on to my waist, the one behind will hold on to him. If you feel that you are going to fall, speak up.
Achilles and I exchanged a look quickly. He stepped forward.
How should I? I will kneel.
His horse legs folded themselves into the dust. His back was broad and lightly sheened with sweat.
Take my arm for balance, the centaur instructed.
Achilles did, swinging his leg over and settling himself. It was my turn. At least I would not be in front, so close to that place where skin gave way to chestnut coat. Chiron offered me his arm, and I took it. It was muscled and large, thickly covered with black hair that was nothing like the color of his horse half. I seated myself, my legs stretched across that wide back, almost to discomfort. Chiron said,
I will stand now.
The motion was smooth, but still I grabbed for Achilles. Chiron was half as high again as a normal horse, and my feet dangled so far above the ground it made me dizzy. Achilles' hands rested loosely on Chiron's trunk.
You will fall if you hold so lightly, the centaur said.
My fingers grew damp with sweat from clutching Achilles' chest. I dared not relax them, even for a moment. The centaur's gait was less symmetrical than a horse's, and the ground was uneven. I slipped alarmingly upon the sweat-slick horsehair. There was no path I could see, but we were rising swiftly upwards through the trees, carried along by Chiron's sure, unslowing steps. I winced every time a jounce caused my heels to kick into the centaur's sides. As we went, Chiron pointed things out to us in that same steady voice.
There is Mount Othrys. The cypress trees are thicker here, on the north side, you can see. This stream feeds the Apidanos River that runs through Thyra's lands.
Achilles twisted back to look at me, grinning. We climbed higher still, and the centaur swished his great black tail, swatting flies for all of us. Chiron stopped suddenly, and I jerked forward into Achilles' back. We were in a small break in the woods, a grove of sorts, half encircled by a rocky outcrop. We were not quite at the peak, but we were close, and the sky was blue and glowing above us.
We are here.
Chiron knelt, and we stepped off his back, a bit unsteadily. In front of us was a cave, but to call it that is to demean it, for it was not made of dark stone but pale rose quartz.
Come,
the centaur said. We followed him through the entrance, high enough so that he did not need to stoop. We blinked, for it was shadowy inside, though lighter than it should have been because of the crystal walls. At one end was a small spring that seemed to drain away inside the rock. On the walls hung things I did not recognize, strange bronze implements. Above us, on the cave ceiling, lines and specks of dye shaped the constellations and the movements of the heavens. On carved shelves were dozens of small ceramic jars covered with slanted markings. Instruments hung in one corner, lyres and flutes, and next to them, tools and cooking pots. There was a single human-sized bed, thick and padded with animal skins made up for Achilles. I did not see where the centaur slept. Perhaps he did not.
Sit now, he said.
It was pleasantly cool inside, perfect after the sun, and I sank gratefully onto one of the cushions Chiron indicated. He went to the spring and filled cups, which he brought to us. The water was sweet and fresh. I drank as Chiron stood over me.
You will be sore and tired tomorrow, he told me, but it will be better if you eat.
He ladled out stew, thick with chunks of vegetables and meat, from a pot simmering over a small fire at the back of the cave. There were fruits, too, round red berries that he kept in a hollowed outcropping of rock. I ate quickly, surprised at how hungry I was. My eyes kept returning to Achilles, and I tingled with the giddy buoyancy of relief. I have escaped. With my new boldness, I pointed to some of the bronze tools on the wall. What are those? Chiron sat across from us, his horse legs folded beneath him.
They are for surgery, he told me.
Surgery. It was not a word I knew.
Healing. I forget the barbarities of the Low Countries.
His voice was neutral and calm, factual.
Sometimes a limb must go. Those are for cutting, those for suturing. Often, by removing some, we may save the rest.
He watched me staring at them, taking in the sharp, saw-toothed edges.
Do you wish to learn medicine?
I flushed. I don't know anything about it.
You answer a different question than the one I asked.
I'm sorry, Master Chiron. I did not want to anger him. He will send me back.
There is no need to be sorry. Simply answer.
I stammered a little. Yes, I would like to learn. It seems useful, does it not?
It is very useful, Chiron agreed.
He turned to Achilles, who had been following the conversation.
And you, Pelides, do you also think medicine is useful?
Of course, Achilles said. Please do not call me Pelides. Here I am. I'm just Achilles.
Something passed through Chiron's dark eyes, a flicker that was almost amusement.
Very well. Do you see anything you wish to know of? Those.
Achilles was pointing to the musical instruments, the lyres and flutes and seven-stringed kithara.
Do you play?
Chiron's gaze was steady.
I do.
So do I, said Achilles. I have heard that you taught Heracles and Jason, thick-fingered though they were. Is it true?
It is.
I felt a momentary unreality. He knew Heracles and Jason, had known them as children.
I would like you to teach me.
Chiron's stern face softened.
That is why you have been sent here, so that I may teach you what I know.
In the late afternoon light, Chiron guided us through the ridges near the cave. He showed us where the mountain lions had their dens, and where the river was, slow and sun-warm for us to swim.
You may bathe if you like.
He was looking at me. I had forgotten how grimy I was, sweat-stained and dusty from the road. I ran a hand through my hair and felt the grit.
I will too,
Achilles said. He pulled off his tunic, and a moment after, I followed. The water was cool in the depths, but not unpleasantly so. From the bank, Chiron taught still.
Those are loaches, do you see? And perch.
That is a vimba. You will not find it farther south. You may know it by the upturned mouth and silver belly.
His words mingled with the sound of the river over its rocks, soothing any strangeness there might have been between Achilles and me. There was something in Chiron's face, firm and calm and imbued with authority, that made us children again, with no world beyond this moment's play and this night's dinner. With him near us, it was hard to remember what might have happened on the day by the beach. Even our bodies felt smaller beside the centaur's bulk. How had we thought we were grown? We emerged from the water, sweet and clean, shaking our hair in the last of the sun. I knelt by the bank and used stones to scrub the dirt and sweat from my tunic. I would have to be naked until it dried, but so far did Chiron's influence stretch that I thought nothing of it. We followed Chiron back to the cave, our wrung-dry tunics draped over our shoulders. He stopped occasionally to point out the trails of hair and corncrakes and deer. He told us we would hunt for them in days to come and learn to track. We listened, questioning him eagerly. At Peleus's palace there had been only the dour lyre master for a teacher, or Peleus himself, half drowsing as he spoke. We knew nothing of forestry or the other skills Chiron had spoken of. My mind went back to the implements on the cave's wall. The herbs and tools of healing. Surgery was the word he had used. It was almost full dark when we reached the cave again. Chiron gave us easy tasks, gathering wood and kindling the fire in the clearing at the cave's mouth. After it caught, we lingered by the flames, grateful for their steady warmth in the cooling air. Our bodies were pleasantly tired, heavy from our exertions, and our legs and feet tangled comfortably as we sat. We talked about where we'd go tomorrow, but lazily, our words fat and slow with contentment. Dinner was more stew, and a thin type of bread that Chiron cooked on bronze sheets over the fire. For dessert, berries with mountain-gathered honey. As the fire dwindled, my eyes closed in half-dreaming. I was warm, and the ground beneath me was soft with moss and fallen leaves. I could not believe that only this morning I had woken in Peleus's palace. This small clearing, the gleaming walls of the cave within, were more vivid than the pale white palace had ever been. Chiron's voice, when it came, startled me.
"I will tell you that your mother has sent a message, Achilles."
I felt the muscles of Achilles' arm tense against me. I felt my own throat tighten.
"Oh, what did she say?"
His words were careful, neutral.
"She said that should the exiled son of Menoetius follow you, I was to bar him from your presence."
I sat up, all drowsiness gone. Achilles' voice swung carelessly in the dark.
"Did she say why?"
"She did not."
I closed my eyes. At least I would not be humiliated before Chiron, the tale of the day at the beach told. But it was bare comfort. Chiron continued.
"I assume you knew of her feelings on the matter. I do not like to be deceived."
My face flushed, and I was glad of the darkness. The centaur's voice sounded harder than it had before. I cleared my throat, rusty and suddenly dry. "I'm sorry," I heard myself say. It is not Achilles' fault. I came on my own. He did not know that I would. I did not think..." I stopped myself. "I hoped she would not notice."
"That was foolish of you."
Chiron's face was deep in shadow.
"Chiron,"
Achilles began bravely. The centaur held up a hand.
"As it happens, the message came this morning, before either of you arrived. So, despite your foolishness, I was not deceived." "You knew?"
This was Achilles. I would never have spoken so boldly.
"Then you have decided. You will disregard her message."
Chiron's voice held a warning of displeasure.
"She is a goddess, Achilles, and your mother besides. Do you think so little of her wishes? I honor her, Chiron, but she is wrong in this."
His hands were balled so tightly I could see the tendons, even in the low light.
"And why is she wrong, Pelides?"
I watched him through the darkness, my stomach clenching. I did not know what he might say.
"She feels that..."
He faltered a moment, and I almost did not breathe.
"That he is a mortal, and not a fit companion." "Do you think he is?"
Chiron asked. His voice gave no hint of the answer.
"Yes."
My cheeks warmed. Achilles, his jaw jutting, had thrown the word back with no hesitation.
"I see."
The centaur turned to me.
"And you, Patroclus, you are worthy?"
I swallowed. "I do not know if I am worthy, but I wish to stay." I paused, swallowed again. "Please?" There was silence. Then Chiron said,
"When I brought you both here, I had not decided yet what I would do. Thetis sees many faults, some that are, and some that are not.
His voice was unreadable again. Hope and despair flared and died in me by turns.
She is also young, and has the prejudices of her kind. I am older, and flatter myself that I can read a man more clearly. I have no objection to Patroclus as your companion.
My body felt hollow in its relief, as if a storm had gone through.
She will not be pleased, but I have weathered the anger of gods before.
He paused.
And now it is late, and time for you to sleep. Thank you, Master Chiron.
Achilles' voice, earnest and vigorous. We stood, but I hesitated. I just want... My fingers twitched towards Chiron. Achilles understood and disappeared into the cave. I turned to face the centaur. I will leave, if there will be trouble. There was a long silence, and I almost thought he had not heard me. At last he said,
"Do not let what you gained this day be so easily lost."
Then he bade me good night, and I turned to join Achilles in the cave. Chapter 9. The next morning, I woke to the soft sounds of Chiron getting breakfast ready. The pallet was thick beneath me. I had slept well and deeply. I stretched, startling a little when my limbs bumped against Achilles, still asleep beside me. I watched him a moment, rosy cheeks and steady breaths. Something tugged at me, just beneath my skin. But then Chiron lifted a hand in greeting from across the cave, and I lifted one shyly in return, and it was forgotten. That day, after we ate, we joined Chiron for his chores. It was easy, pleasurable work, collecting berries, catching fish for dinner, setting quail snares. The beginning of our studies, if it is possible to call them that. For Chiron liked to teach, not in set lessons, but in opportunities. When the goats that wandered the ridges took ill, we learned how to mix purgatives for their bad stomachs, and when they were well again, how to make a poultice that repelled their ticks. When I fell down a ravine, fracturing my arm and tearing open my knee, we learned how to set splints, clean wounds, and what herbs to give against infection. On a hunting trip, after we had accidentally flushed a corncrake from its nest, he taught us how to move silently and how to read the scuffles of tracks. And when we had found the animal, the best way to aim a bow or sling so that death was quick. If we were thirsty and had no water skin, he would teach us about the plants whose roots carried beads of moisture. When a mountain ash fell, we learned carpentry, splitting off the bark, sanding, and shaping the wood that was left. I made an axe handle, and Achilles the shaft of a spear. Chiron said that soon we would learn to forge the blades for such things. Every evening and every morning we helped with meals, churning the thick goat's milk for yogurt and cheese, gutting fish. It was work we had never been allowed to do before as princes, and we fell upon it eagerly. Following Chiron's instructions, we watched in amazement as butter formed before our eyes, at the way pheasant eggs sizzled and solidified on fire-warmed rocks. After a month, over breakfast, Chiron asked us what else we wished to learn. "Those," I pointed to the instruments on the wall. "For surgery," he had said. He took them down for us, one by one.
"Careful. The blade is very sharp. It is for when there is rot in the flesh that must be cut. Press the skin around the wound, and you will hear a crackle."
Then he had us trace the bones in our own bodies, running a hand over the ridging vertebrae of each other's backs. He pointed with his fingers, teaching the places beneath the skin where the organs lodged.
"A wound in any of them will eventually be fatal, but death is quickest here."
His finger tapped the slight concavity of Achilles' temple. A chill went through me to see it touched, that place where Achilles' life was so slenderly protected. I was glad when we spoke of other things. At night, we lay on the soft grass in front of the cave, and Chiron showed us the constellations, telling their stories. Andromeda, cowering before the sea monster's jaws, and Perseus, poised to rescue her, the immortal horse Pegasus, aloft on his wings, born from the severed neck of Medusa. He told us too of Heracles, his labors, and the madness that took him. In its grip, he had not recognized his wife and children, and had killed them for enemies. Achilles asked, how could he not recognize his wife?
That is the nature of madness, Chiron said. His voice sounded deeper than usual.
He had known this man, I remembered, had known the wife.
But why did the madness come?
The gods wished to punish him, Chiron answered.
Achilles shook his head impatiently.
But this was a greater punishment for her. It was not fair of them.
There is no law that gods must be fair, Achilles, Chiron said. And perhaps it is the greater grief, after all, to be left on earth when another is gone. Do you think?
Perhaps, Achilles admitted.
I listened and did not speak. Achilles' eyes were bright in the firelight, his face drawn sharply by the flickering shadows. I would know it in dark or disguise, I told myself. I would know it, even in madness.
Come, said Chiron. Have I told you the legend of Asclepius, and how he came to know the secrets of healing?
He had, but we wanted to hear it again. The story of how the hero, son of Apollo, had spared a snake's life. The snake had licked his ears clean in gratitude, so that he might hear her whisper the secrets of herbs to him.
But you were the one who really taught him healing, Achilles said.
I was.
You do not mind that the snake gets all the credit?
Chiron's teeth showed through his dark beard, a smile.
No, Achilles, I do not mind.
Later, Achilles would play the lyre as Chiron and I listened. My mother's lyre. He had brought it with him. I wish I had known, I said the first day when he had showed it to me. I almost did not come, because I did not want to leave it. He smiled.
Now I know how to make you follow me everywhere.
The sun sank below Pelion's ridges, and we were happy. Time passed quickly on Mount Pelion, days slipping by in idle. The mountain air was cold now in the mornings when we woke, and warmed only reluctantly in the thin sunlight that filtered through the dying leaves. Chiron gave us furs to wear, and hung animal skins from the cave's entrance to keep the warmth in. During the days, we collected wood for winter fires or salted meat for preserving. The animals had not yet gone to their dens, but they would soon, Chiron said. In the mornings, we marveled at the frost-etched leaves. We knew of snow from bards and stories. We had never seen it. One morning, I woke to find Chiron gone. This was not unusual. He often rose before we did, to milk the goats or pick fruits for breakfast. I left the cave so that Achilles might sleep, and sat to wait for Chiron in the clearing. The ashes of last night's fire were white and cold. I stirred them idly with a stick, listening to the woods around me. A quail muttered in the underbrush, and a mourning dove called. I heard the rustle of ground cover, from the wind or an animal's careless weight. In a moment, I would get more wood and rekindle the fire. The strangeness began as a prickling of my skin. First, the quail went silent, then the dove. The leaves stilled, and the breeze died, and no animals moved in the brush. There was a quality to the silence like a held breath, like the rabbit beneath the hawk's shadow. I could feel my pulse striking my skin. Sometimes, I reminded myself, Chiron did small magics, tricks of divinity, like warming water or calming animals. Chiron, I called. My voice wavered thinly. Chiron?
It is not Chiron.
I turned. Thetis stood at the edge of the clearing, her bone-white skin and black hair bright as slashes of lightning. The dress she wore clung close to her body and shimmered like fish scale. My breath died in my throat.
You were not to be here,
she said, the scrape of jagged rocks against a ship's hull. She stepped forward, and the grass seemed to wilt beneath her feet. She was a sea nymph, and the things of Earth did not love her. I'm sorry, I managed, my voice a dried leaf, rattling in my throat.
I warned you, she said.
The black of her eyes seemed to seep into me, fill my throat to choking. I could not have cried out if I'd dared to. A noise behind me, and then Chiron's voice, loud in the quiet.
Greetings, Thetis.
Warmth surged back into my skin, and breath returned. I almost ran to him, but her gaze held me there, unwavering. I did not doubt she could reach me if she wished.
You are frightening the boy,
Chiron said.
He does not belong here, she said.
Her lips were red as newly spilled blood. Chiron's hand landed firmly on my shoulder.
Patroclus, he said. You will return to the cave now. I will speak with you later.
I stood, unsteadily, and obeyed.
You have lived too long with mortals, Centaur,
I heard her say before the animal skins closed behind me. I sagged against the cave's wall. My throat tasted brackish and raw. Achilles, I said. His eyes opened, and he was beside me before I could speak again.
Are you all right?
Your mother is here, I said. I saw the tightening of muscle beneath his skin.
She did not hurt you.
I shook my head. I did not add that I thought she wanted to. That she might have, if Chiron had not come.
I must go, he said.
The skins whispered against each other as they parted for him, then slipped shut again. I could not hear what was said in the clearing. Their voices were low, or perhaps they had gone to speak elsewhere. I waited, tracing spirals in the packed earth floor. I did not worry any longer for myself. Chiron meant to keep me, and he was older than she was, full grown when the gods still rocked in their cradles, when she had been only an egg in the womb of the sea. But there was something else, less easy to name, a loss or lessening that I feared her presence might bring. It was almost midday when they returned. My gaze went to Achilles' face first, searching his eyes, the set of his mouth. I saw nothing but perhaps a touch of tiredness. He threw himself onto the pallet beside me.
I'm hungry, he said.
As well you should be,
Chiron said.
It is much past lunch.
He was already preparing food for us, maneuvering in the cave's space easily despite his bulk. Achilles turned to me.
It is all right, he said. She just wanted to speak to me, to see me. She will come to speak with him again,
Chiron said, and as if he knew what I thought, he added,
as is proper, she is his mother.
She is a goddess first, I thought. Yet, as we ate, my fears eased. I had half worried she might have told Chiron of the day by the beach, but he was no different towards either of us, and Achilles was the same as he always was. I went to bed, if not at peace, at least reassured. She came more often after that day, as Chiron had said she would. I learned to listen for it, a silence that dropped like a curtain, and knew to stay close to Chiron then and the cave. The intrusion was not much, and I told myself I did not begrudge her, but I was always glad when she was gone again. Winter came, and the river froze. Achilles and I ventured onto it, feet slipping. Later, we cut circles from it and dropped lines for fishing. It was the only fresh meat we had. The forests were empty of all but mice and the occasional marten. Snows came, as Chiron had promised they would. We lay on the ground and let the flakes cover us, blowing them with our breath till they melted. We had no boots nor cloaks other than Chiron's furs and were glad of the cave's warmth. Even Chiron donned a shaggy overshirt, sewed from what he said was bearskin. We counted the days after the first snowfall, marking them off with lines on a stone.
When you reach 50,
Chiron said.
The river's ice will begin to crack.
The morning of the 50th day, we heard it. A strange sound like a tree falling. A seam had split the frozen surface nearly from bank to bank.
Spring will come soon now, Chiron said.
It was not long after that the grass began to grow again, and the squirrels emerged, lean and whip-thin from their burrows. We followed them, eating our breakfasts in the new scrubbed spring air. It was on one of these mornings that Achilles asked Chiron if he would teach us to fight. I do not know what made him think of this then. A winter indoors with not enough exercise, perhaps, or the visit from his mother the week before. Perhaps neither. Will you teach us to fight? There was a pause so brief I almost might have imagined it before Chiron answered.
If you wish it, I will teach you.
Later that day, he took us to a clearing high on a ridge. He had spear hafts and two practice swords for us, taken from storage in some corner of the cave. He asked us each to perform the drills that we knew. I did, slowly, the blocks and strikes and footwork I had learned in Thyre. To my side, just at the corner of my vision, Achilles' limbs blurred and struck. Chiron had brought a bronze-banded staff, and he interposed it occasionally into our passes, probing with it, testing our reactions. It seemed to go on for a long time, and my arms grew sore with lifting and placing the point of the sword. At last, Chiron called a stop. We drank deep from water skins and lay back on the grass. My chest was heaving. Achilles was steady. Chiron was silent, standing in front of us.
Well, what do you think?
Achilles was eager, and I remembered that Chiron was only the fourth person to have ever seen him fight. I did not know what I expected the centaur to say, but it was not what followed.
There is nothing I can teach you. You know all that Heracles knew, and more. You are the greatest warrior of your generation, and all the generations before.
A flush stained Achilles' cheeks. I could not tell if it was embarrassment or pleasure, or both.
Men will hear of your skill, and they will wish for you to fight their wars.
He paused.
What will you answer?
I do not know, Achilles said.
That is an answer for now. It will not be good enough later, Chiron said.
There was a silence then, and I felt the tightness in the air around us. Achilles' face, for the first time since we had come, looked pinched and solemn. What about me? I asked. Chiron's dark eyes moved to rest on mine.
You will never gain fame from your fighting. Is this surprising to you?
His tone was matter-of-fact, and somehow that eased the sting of it. No, I said truthfully.
Yet it is not beyond you to be a competent soldier. Do you wish to learn this?
I thought of the boy's dulled eyes, how quickly his blood had soaked the ground. I thought of Achilles, the greatest warrior of his generation. I thought of Thetis, who would take him from me, if she could. No, I said. And that was the end of our lessons in soldiery. Spring passed into summer, and the woods grew warm and abundant, lush with game and fruit. Achilles turned 14, and messengers brought gifts for him from Peleus. It was strange to see them here, in their uniforms and palace colors. I watched their eyes flickering over me, over Achilles, over Chiron most of all. Gossip was dear in the palace, and these men would be received like kings when they returned. I was glad to see them shoulder their empty trunks and be gone. The gifts were welcome. New lyre strings and fresh tunics spun from the finest wool. There was a new bow as well, and arrows tipped with iron. We fingered their metal, the keen-edged points that would bring down our dinners in days to come. Some things were less useful, cloaks stiff with inlaid gold that would give the owner's presence away at 50 paces, and a jewel-studded belt too heavy to wear for anything practical. There was a horse coat as well, thickly embroidered, meant to adorn the mount of a prince.
I hope that is not from me,
Chiron said, lifting an eyebrow. We tore it up for compresses and bandages and scrub cloths. The rough material was perfect for pulling up crusted dirt and food. That afternoon, we lay on the grass in front of the cave.
It has been almost a year since we came,
Achilles said. The breeze was cool against our skin. It does not feel so long, I answered. I was half sleepy, my eyes lost in the tilting blue of the afternoon sky.
Do you miss the palace?
I thought of his father's gifts, the servants and their gazes, the whispering gossip they would bring back to the palace. No, I said.
I don't either, he said. I thought I might, but I don't.
The days turned, and the months, and 2 years passed. Chapter 10. It was spring, and we were 15. The winter ice had lasted longer than usual, and we were glad to be outside once more beneath the sun. Our tunics were discarded, and our skin prickled in the light breeze. I had not been so naked all winter. It had been too cold to take off our furs and cloaks beyond quick washes in the hollowed-out rock that served as our bath. Achilles was stretching, rolling limbs that were stiff from too long indoors. We had spent the morning swimming and chasing game through the forest. My muscles felt wearily content, glad to be used again. I watched him. Other than the unsteady surface of the river, there were no mirrors on Mount Pelion, so I could only measure myself by the changes in Achilles. His limbs were still slender, but I could see the muscles in them now, rising and falling beneath his skin as he moved. His face, too, was firmer, and his shoulders broader than they had been.
You look older, I said.
He stopped, turned to me.
I do.
Yes, I nodded.
Do I? Come over here, he said.
I stood, walked to him. He regarded me a moment.
Yes,
he said. How? I wanted to know. A lot?
Your face is different, he said.
Where? He touched my jaw with his right hand, drew his fingertips along it.
Here. Your face is wider than it once was.
I reached up with my own hand to see if I could feel this difference, but it was all the same to me, bone and skin. He took my hand and brought it down to my collarbone.
You are wider here also, he said. And this.
His finger touched gently the soft bulb that had emerged from my throat. I swallowed and felt his fingertip ride against the motion. Where else? I asked. He pointed to the trail of fine dark hair that ran down my chest and over my stomach. He paused, and my face grew warm. That's enough, I said, more abruptly than I meant to. I sat again on the grass, and he resumed his stretches. I watched the breeze stir his hair. I watched the sun fall on his golden skin. I leaned back and let it fall on me as well. After some time, he stopped and came to sit beside me. We watched the grass and the trees and the nubs of new buds just growing. His voice was remote, almost careless.
You would not be displeased, I think, with how you look now.
My face grew warm again, but we spoke no more of it. We were almost 16. Soon Peleus's messengers would come with gifts. Soon the berries would ripen, the fruits would blush and fall into our hands. 16 was our last year of childhood, the year before our fathers named us men, and we would begin to wear not just tunics but capes and chitons as well. A marriage would be arranged for Achilles, and I might take a wife if I wished to. I thought again of the serving girls with their dull eyes. I remembered the snatches of conversation I had overheard from the boys, the talk of breasts and hips and coupling. She's like cream, she's that soft. Once her thighs are around you, you'll forget your own name. The boys' voices had been sharp with excitement, their color high. But when I tried to imagine what they spoke of, my mind slid away like a fish who would not be caught. Other images came in their stead. The curve of a neck bent over a lyre, hair gleaming in firelight, hands with their flickering tendons. We were together all day, and I could not escape. The smell of the oils he used on his feet, the glimpses of skin as he dressed. I would wrench my gaze from him and remember the day on the beach, the coldness in his eyes, and how he ran from me. And, always, I remembered his mother. I began to go off by myself, early in the mornings when Achilles still slept, or in the afternoons when he would practice his spear thrusts. I brought a flute with me, but rarely played it. Instead, I would find a tree to lean against and breathe the sharp drift of cypress scent, blown from the highest part of the mountain. Slowly, as if to escape my own notice, my hand would move to rest between my thighs. There was shame in this thing that I did, and a greater shame still in the thoughts that came with it. But it would be worse to think them inside the rose quartz cave, with him beside me. It was difficult sometimes, after, to return to the cave.
"Where were you?"
he'd ask. "Just," I'd say, and point vaguely. He'd nod, but I knew he saw the flush that colored my cheeks. The summer grew hotter, and we sought the river's shade, its water that threw off arcs of light as we splashed and dove. The rocks of the bottom were mossy and cool, rolling beneath my toes as I waded. We shouted and frightened the fish, who fled to their muddy holes or quieter waters upstream. The rushing ice melt of spring was gone. I lay on my back and let the dozy current carry me. I liked the feel of the sun on my stomach and the cool depths of the river beneath me. Achilles floated beside me or swam against the slow tug of the river's flow. When we tired of this, we would seize the low-hanging branches of the osiers and hoist ourselves half out of the water. On this day, we kicked at each other, our legs tangling, trying to dislodge the other, or perhaps climb onto their branch. On an impulse, I released my branch and seized him around his hanging torso. He let out an oof of surprise. We struggled that way for a moment, laughing, my arms wrapped around him. Then there was a sharp cracking sound and his branch gave way, plunging us into the river. The cool water closed over us, and still we wrestled, hands against slippery skin. When we surfaced, we were panting and eager. He leapt for me, bearing down through the clear water. We grappled, emerged to gasp air, then sank again. At length, our lungs burning, our faces red from too long underwater, we dragged ourselves to the bank and lay there amidst the sedge grass and marshy weeds. Our feet sank into the cool mud of the water's edge. Water still streamed from his hair, and I watched it bead, tracing across his arms and the lines of his chest. On the morning of his 16th birthday, I woke early. Chiron had showed me a tree on Pelion's far slope that had figs just ripening, the first of the season. Achilles did not know of it, the centaur assured me. I watched them for days, their hard green knots swelling and darkening, growing gravid with seed, and now I would pick them for his breakfast. It wasn't my only gift. I had found a seasoned piece of ash and began to fashion it secretly, carving off its soft layers. Over nearly 2 months a shape had emerged, a boy playing the lyre, head raised to the sky, mouth open as if he was singing. I had it with me now as I walked. The figs hung rich and heavy on the tree, their curved flesh pliant to my touch. 2 days later, and they would be too ripe. I gathered them in a carved wood bowl and bore them carefully back to the cave. Achilles was sitting in the clearing with Chiron, a new box from Peleus resting unopened at his feet. I saw the quick widening of his eyes as he took in the figs. He was on his feet, eagerly reaching into the bowl before I could even set it down beside him. We ate until we were stuffed, our fingers and chins sticky with sweetness. The box from Peleus held more tunics and lyre strings, and this time, for his 16th birthday, a cloak dyed with the expensive purple from the murex's shell. It was the cape of a prince, of a future king, and I saw that it pleased him. It would look good on him, I knew, the purple seeming richer still beside the gold of his hair. Chiron, too, gave presents, a staff for hiking and a new belt knife. At last, I passed him the statue. He examined it, his fingertips moving over the small marks my knife had left behind. "It's you," I said, grinning foolishly. He looked up, and there was bright pleasure in his eyes. "I know," he said. One evening, not long after, we stayed late beside the fire's embers. Achilles had been gone for much of the afternoon. Thetis had come and kept him longer even than usual. Now he was playing my mother's lyre. The music was quiet and bright as the stars over our heads. Next to me, I heard Chiron yawn, settle more deeply onto his folded legs. A moment later, the lyre ceased, and Achilles' voice came loud in the darkness.
"Are you weary, Chiron?"
"I am."
"Then we will leave you to your rest."
He was not usually so quick to go, nor to speak for me, but I was tired myself and did not object. He rose and bade Chiron good night, turning for the cave. I stretched, soaked up a few more moments of firelight, and followed. Inside the cave, Achilles was already in bed, his face damp from a wash at the spring. I washed too, the water cool across my forehead. He said,
"You didn't ask me about my mother's visit yet."
I said, "How is she?"
"She is well."
This was the answer he always gave. It was why I sometimes did not ask him.
"Good."
I lifted a handful of water to rinse the soap off my face. We made it from the oil of olives, and it still smelled faintly of them, rich and buttery. Achilles spoke again.
"She says she cannot see us here."
I had not been expecting him to say more.
"Hmm?" "She cannot see us here, on Pelion."
There was something in his voice, a strain. I turned to him. "What do you mean?" His eyes studied the ceiling.
"She says, I asked her if she watches us here."
His voice was high.
"She says she does not."
There was silence in the cave, silence but for the sound of slowly draining water. "Oh," I said.
"I wish to tell you because..."
He paused.
"I thought you would wish to know. She..."
He hesitated again.
"She was not pleased that I asked her."
"She was not pleased," I repeated. I felt dizzy, my mind turning and turning through his words. "She cannot see us." I realized that I was standing half frozen by the water basin, the towel still raised to my chin. I forced myself to put down the cloth, to move to the bed. There was a wildness in me, of hope and terror. I pulled back the covers and lay down on bedding already warm from his skin. His eyes were still fixed on the ceiling. "Are you pleased with her answer?" I said finally.
"Yes,"
he said. We lay there a moment, in that strained and living silence. Usually at night we would tell each other jokes or stories. The ceiling above us was painted with the stars, and if we grew tired of talking, we would point to them. "Orion," I would say, following his finger. "The Pleiades." But tonight there was nothing. I closed my eyes and waited long minutes until I guessed he was asleep. Then I turned to look at him. He was on his side watching me. I had not heard him turn. I never hear him. He was utterly motionless, that stillness that was his alone. I breathed and was aware of the bare stretch of dark pillow between us. He leaned forward. Our mouths opened under each other, and the warmth of his sweetened throat poured into mine. I could not think, could not do anything but drink him in, each breath as it came, the soft movement of his lips. It was a miracle. I was trembling, afraid to put him to flight. I did not know what to do, what he would like. I kissed his neck, the span of his chest, and tasted the salt. He seemed to swell beneath my touch, to ripen. He smelled like almonds and earth. He pressed against me, crushing my lips to whine. He went still as I took him in my hand, soft as the delicate velvet of petals. I knew Achilles' golden skin and the curve of